Okay, thanks, Alana. We are running well ahead of time, which is good. That's fine. But to remind everybody, if you do have questions or want to go over something again, feel free to definitely ask questions. But with that, I guess where we're at now is steelmaking coal operations. And so, Ryan, I'll turn the floor over to you.
Okay, thank you, Fraser, and good morning, everyone. I'll begin on slide number 3 with our steelmaking coal strategy, followed by about 14 slides that will provide the details on how to model the coal business unit and some additional color on our financial results. The 4 key overarching coal strategic pillars are safe and sustainable and productive operations. Second, the business unit has the potential to produce approximately 27 million tons for decades. Thirdly, maximizing and sustaining strong cash flow, focusing on our new cost reduction program and targets, as well as sustaining our improved productivities. And fourthly, executing on digital transformation and innovation that will deliver exceptional results, which will be focused on and delivered through our Race 21 program, which we've announced previously. So moving on to slide 4, in 2019, our 6 steelmaking coal operations in Western Canada, you can see on the map there, are geographically concentrated in the Elk Valley, produced 25.7 million tons of coal with sales of 25 million tons. The majority of our sales are to the Asia-Pacific region, with lesser amounts going primarily to Europe and the Americas. Our long-term production capacity is approximately 27 million tons, and we have total proven and probable reserves of 840 million tons of steelmaking coal. It is important to point out that we closed Coal Mountain operations in the second quarter of 2019, and we will be moving our Cardinal River operation in Alberta to closure in Q3 of this year. The reduction in production capacity from these closures will be made up by our other Elk Valley mines. I'll go into more detail in a few slides. In December 2019, we announced a long-term rail agreement with CN for shipping of our steelmaking coal from our 4 BC operations between Kamloops and Neptune terminals and other West Coast ports. The agreement runs from April 2021 to December 2026 and will enable us to significantly increase shipment volumes through an expanded Neptune terminal. Westbound rail service for the mines located in the Elk Valley is currently provided by the Canadian Pacific Railway Company, CPR, which we have a 10-year agreement that does expire in 2021. CPR transports a portion of these westbound shipments from Kamloops, BC, and then interchanges the trains with the Canadian National Railway Company for further transportation to the West Coast. CN also provides rail service from Cardinal River Mine to the West Coast. Looking at our pricing mechanisms that impact the average realized price on slide 5, this slide compares our sales that are linked to the index versus fixed price sales, as well as our sales mix, our product mix, and factors impacting our average realized steelmaking coal price. Just wanted to point out, effective April 1st, 2017, a changing pricing methodology occurred for our quarterly contract sales from a negotiated quarterly benchmark to an index-linked pricing mechanism based on the average of key premium steelmaking coal price assessments. Quarterly price sales represent approximately 40% of tech sales, with the balance of tech sales priced at levels reflecting market conditions when sales are actually concluded. Lower grade semi soft coals and pulverized coal injection PCI pricing continue to be negotiated on a quarterly benchmark basis. Substantially all of our revenues from our sales of our coal products were derived from sales to third-party end users, mostly of which are steel makers. In 2019, sales to Asia accounts for approximately 80% of our annual coal sales volume, which was a record high, and that was mainly due to increased sales volume to areas with the greatest demand growth, such as India, and then reduced sales to Europe due to the impact of steel production curtailments implemented in July and disclosed in Q3 last year. Looking at our sales mix, approximately 40% of our sales are based on the quarterly contract price, which is based on the last 3 months with a 1-month lag, and approximately 60% based on shorter than the quarterly price mechanism, including spot, which is the average monthly price when sales are concluded. Looking at our product mix that impacts our average realized price on slide 6, approximately 75% of all coal we produce is high-quality hard coking coal, although the percentages can vary from period to period. We also produce lesser quality semi-hard coking coal, semi-soft coking coal, and PCI coal products, which in aggregate accounted for almost 25% of our annual sales volume in 2019. A byproduct of our steelmaking coal production is thermal coal, which accounted for approximately 2% of our total coal sales volume in 2019. On a U.S. dollar basis, historically over the past 10 years, we have realized an average price of approximately 92% of the quality differential to the quarterly benchmark price. These factors impacting price is reflective of our product mix, timing of our sales, direction and underlying volatility of daily price assessments, spreads between various qualities of steelmaking coal, and arbitrage between FOB Australia and CFR China pricing. This now brings us to a simplified annual model for our steelmaking coal operations on slide 7. You can see a 3-year history of our actual reported numbers in the table throughout the next few slides. Note that the math does not work exactly at every stage as we are presenting a simplified version, but you should get reasonably close. To start here, to build an annual revenue model, you start with sales. We recommend that you assume that our sales are equivalent to production for the full year. We provide production guidance for the following year in our Q4 report annually. Note that this can be refined by our sales guidance for the following quarter in each quarterly report. To calculate the average realized price for the year, you need to start with your own forecast for the average annual benchmark price. The benchmark price, as reported by Industry News, is a quarterly benchmark in line with the majority of the contracts, which we are now on a quarterly basis as well. You then multiply your price forecast by your assumption for your average realized price percentage of the benchmark price. Based on our previous slide, we would expect an average of 92% historically. We report in Canadian dollars, so you then convert to Canadian dollars using your own forecast for the Canadian to U.S. dollar exchange rate. Following, you can then calculate a revenue forecast by multiplying sales by average realized Canadian, by the average realized price in Canadian dollars. In addition, you then need to add royalties that are paid to TEC from our joint venture partner, POSCAN. I'll go through this calculation on the next slide. So moving on to slide 8, where I'll walk through the royalty impact from POSCAN. Just a little bit of context. On February 11, 2019, we agreed with POSCAN to a reopener in the Greenhills joint venture agreement. And that was to increase the royalty paid by POSCAN in respect of its 20% share of Greenhills coal production. TEC Coal is the manager and operator of Greenhills and takes 80% of all the coal produced in Greenhills. POSCAN takes the remaining 20% and pays a quarterly royalty based on the price achieved for Greenhills coal sales. For context, as noted on the table showing a 3-year historical view, as a result of the new agreement, the royalty we received increased by $74 million from $21 million in 2018 to $95 million in 2019. At current exchange rates, meaning the average FX in 2019 throughout the modeling tables in this deck, a U.S. $10 per ton change in the coal price would increase or decrease the royalty by $6 million Canadian. The new royalty is calculated quarterly and amounts to approximately 2% of our total sales, and the agreement remains in effect until December 31st, 2022. Looking at slide 9, a simplified view of how to model unit costs. We provide annual guidance ranges for our unit costs. Typically, we provide ranges for both our coal site cost of sales and coal transportation costs annually. The sum of these would be our combined coal costs for total cash unit costs, and is reported in a table in the steelmaking coal section of our quarterly press releases. To calculate our total unit cost of sales per IFRS, you would make an assumption or depreciation and amortization unit cost, and add that to our total cash unit cost. You can refer to our history over the past 3 years in making your assumption. We would recommend taking an average of the last 3 years for depreciation and amortization for modeling purposes. Moving on to slide 10, we look at our total annual costs. Here you simply multiply each category of unit cost by our sales and add them together. Note that we also have some royalties and coal that relate to Cardinal River and are disclosed in our AIF, but they are relatively a small component. You can see $20 million there in 2019 and $17 million in 2018. In addition, as discussed previously on my first slide and second slide, Cardinal River will move to closure in 2020, and we recommend removing Cardinal River's royalties post-2020. This brings us to slide 11 to walk through gross profit. Here, simply, you would take your forecast for revenue and total cash costs from the previous slides and calculate the difference for gross profit before depreciation and amortization. Moving on to slide 12. And what we're talking about on this slide is unit cost of sales, which has been broken out into various buckets to show what makes up our cost in 2019. Transportation costs make up approximately 29% of our unit cost. Cardinal River royalties, 1%. You see depreciation and amortization, 23%, and operating costs at 48%. Our operating costs breakdown in the table on the right-hand side of the slide is split between the key cost drivers that make up close to 50% of our total unit cost. It's important to note, we would expect some of these percentages to change in a high versus low coal price environment. For example, contractors and consultants would decrease or increase based on the non-routine scope of work required in a typical year. Also, repairs and maintenance parts will vary depending on the timing of component changeouts on our mobile fleets, as well as our replacement strategy. The largest component in our energy spend is diesel, and diesel costs account for 14% of our operating costs, and other energy accounts for 3%, as an example, in 2019. Finally, this brings us to our last modeling slide showing the view of all in sustaining cash cost view in a typical year. You got 3 years of history there. You would simply take total cash costs plus capitalized stripping and our sustaining capex to get an all-in sustaining cost for the coal business unit. Our capitalized stripping in 2020 guidance is $350 to $400 million. We recommend to use this amount for capitalized stripping for modeling purposes. In addition, you will also find our annualized capitalized stripping amount in our Q4 release as guidance. I'll go into more detail regarding our sustaining capital spend on the next slide. So next slide here on slide 14, I want to spend some time highlighting other considerations for steelmaking coal modeling. The steelmaking coal business unit is starting to see the benefits of the company-wide cost reduction program that we announced in Q3 2019. We expect spending to decrease by approximately $100 million of operating cost reductions through 2020 compared to 2019. Please note that this amount excludes capital reductions. Looking at our coal capital, our long-term run rate for sustaining capex is approximately $6 per ton, and that is to reinvest in our mobile equipment fleet. On average, our five-year major enhancement spend is expected to be between $145 million to $180 million per year, mostly related to increasing and maintaining our long-term production capacity of 27 million tons. The largest investment is related to increasing plant capacity at our Elkview operations, which is our $9 million project. And secondly, the development of Castle at our Fording River operation. We continue to implement the water quality management measures required by the Elk Valley Water Quality Plan, which is an area-based management plan that was approved in the fourth quarter of 2014 by the British Columbia Minister of Environment. That plan establishes short, medium, and long-term water quality targets for selenium, nitrate, and sulfate to protect the environment and human health, as well as a plan to manage calcite formation. Over the next 4 years, from 2021 to 2024, we plan to invest approximately $350 to $400 million capital to further increase water treatment capacity to 90 million liters per day by the end of 2024. In addition, during the same period, we plan to spend approximately $85 million in capital on source control and calcite management and up to $90 million on tributary-specific treatments. Capital spending in 2020 on our water treatment plan is expected to be approximately $290 million. The majority of that plan spend relates to the completion of our Fording River Active Water Treatment Facility and LP Phase 2 Saturated Rock Fill. Capital spend is expected to be similar in 2021 as of 2020 and then significantly decreased through to 2025. Operating costs associated with water treatment were approximately $1.30 per ton in 2019 and are expected to increase gradually over the long term to about $3 per ton range as additional active water treatment facilities and SRFs, saturated rock fills, become operational. After 2024, ongoing capital costs for construction of additional treatment facilities are expected to average approximately $2 per ton. Note that all these details on water values can be found in our Q4 MD&A. Continuing on to slide 15, we expect quarterly cost of sales to fluctuate quarterly with higher cost of sales in the second and third quarter, typically when our operations are scheduled to complete major plant maintenance outages. Looking on this slide there for mine life and tech interest in clean coal, our Fording River operation at the north end of the Elk Valley is about 29 years of mining at 265.2 million tons. We've got LP operations at 36 years at 256 million tons. Our Green Hills operation about 50 years of mining at 236 million tons. And then Lion Creek at approximately 15 years at 58.3 million tons. And then Race 21 piece, as a note, 2020 targets are not included in our 2020 guidance. Moving on to slide 16. This is the last slide here, and I just wanted to go through a summary on how the BU is setting up for strong long-term cash flows. Our strip ratio is decreasing over the next 4 years. You can see on the chart on the right there, and that is mostly due to our LP operation. And our future strip ratio is on par with the historical average. Strategically, we are replacing high-cost tons with low-cost tons, and that's Cardinal River coming to closure, which will be made up by our LP operation expansion in 2020. We are investing, as I mentioned earlier, in Race 21 technology and digital transformation, which will lower our operating costs and increase EBITDA. And lastly here, increasing our Neptune terminal nameplate capacity to greater than 18.5. This will help lower our operating costs as well as increasing our logistic chain flexibility in the future. This concludes our coal business unit model items, and with that, I'll turn it over to the operator for any questions.
Thank you. Once again, if you have a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our first question is from Gordon Lawson with Paradigm Capital. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. With the current divergence between Australia and Chinese coal prices, how would you recommend we estimate our benchmark price to use for modeling purposes? And what is tech currently doing to take advantage of these differences?
In regards to the best to estimate the prices, we use the average realized price, which is taking 92% of the benchmark price. The difference there is usually made up of the volatility of prices, mostly timing, also product mix, which can be due to our mine sequence changes as well as mine plans, and then any spreads or deltas between the semi-hard coking coal price and hard coking coal price. But for modeling purposes, we'd use 92% of the benchmark.
And Gord, in the premium of the Chinese coals is, you know, significant, has been. But when they come and buying seaborne coal, if you look at what they're actually paying, it's a lot closer to the seaborne price. So there's not, there's not a huge advantage in that from our perspective. The other thing is, you know, what are we doing to take advantage of it to the extent we could? It's worth keeping in mind that we're last year we're, you know, about 10% or a little bit below of our 10% of our revenues were our coal sales, were into China, and that's going down. So it's come down over the years. Right now, or more recently, it's been because sales to India have been rising. So it's, you know, essentially a secular kind of change in our distribution. So our exposure to China in that regard is getting smaller as it is.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from Tony Robson with Global Mining Research. Please go ahead.
Gentlemen, thank you for taking my question, and thanks again to Tech for putting on the workshop. A lot of companies that are harder to model that should be following you guys, I'm afraid, don't, so well done to Tech. Two points, please, in terms of the met coal. One, is there any commercially sensitive reason why you can't break out the higher quality hard met coal to the lower quality, given semi-hard, semi-soft, and PCI is, as you say, 25% of the mix? Would that not help the analyst, A, get better forecasts for revenue, and B, maybe overcome the quarterly issues about, you know, what discount or whatever Tech is getting relative to the market? So that's my first question. Second question is depreciation rates. Is there anything better than just using history? I use, for example, unit of production measures. But does unit of production or a straight line of declining balance for depreciation get us better guidance going forward? Thank you.
I think from the depreciation question, we expect the three-year average historical would be the best average rate to use for depreciation and amortization going forward for modeling purposes. In regard, Fraser, do you want to jump in on in regards to the price?
Yeah, thanks. And Tony, I think the short answer to your question is yes, we do think that that the mix, exact mix of that remaining 25% is commercially sensitive in terms of what our overall you know, product offering is. You know, I just feel, because I think as far as we can tell anyway, there's nobody that none of our competitors that provide that sort of detail, and you know, and so we don't, and it is largely for commercial reasons. You know, I think the best we can do is, I think anybody can do is use a percent of benchmark because of the lack of, you know, of a breakout, and then watch that list of things that we put on that slide that Ryan talked to. Just watch some of those. You know, and in terms of directionally, and try and, you know, vary the percentage perhaps quarter to quarter if we, you know, you see, you know, big changes. You know, one of the obvious red flags or thing, you know, signals to watch what's going on or think about our realization is, you know, when we get big moves in pricing. So for, you know, back in 2017 was spikes to, you know, to over $300 a ton was in terms of the spot price or the index. You know, we don't sell a lot of volume, and nobody does really at those very high prices. And so if something like that happens, then, you know, we're not going to get an arithmetic average in the quarter. And that's going to typically in that case, you know, mean that our percent of the benchmark is lower. Not sure
okay,
it helps much, but we're you know, it is we do think it's commercially sensitive in terms of the specific product mixes.
Okay, understood. Thank you. Follow up on that. The 75-25 mix, perhaps you could talk to what extent that split depends upon market conditions and how much you want to wash the coal to relative to the coal quality you're actually mining. So how much leeway is there in that 75-25 split, please, on a quarter-to-quarter basis?
It'll depend on mine plans and sequence changes and what we're producing in that year.
I don't think it depends so much on washing the coal as Ryan says, what we're mining of the reserves at the time.
Okay, and just very, very briefly, how much would it change quarter to quarter? What's the last couple of years in your history?
Go ahead, Ryan.
I was just going to say, from quarter to quarter, it's pretty consistent. It's more on the annual plan in the year. The one thing that can change quarter to quarter is just the small byproduct we produce as thermal, which is immaterial. It's 2% of our sales.
No further questions. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. There are no further questions registered at this time, so I'll turn the meeting back over to Mr. Phillips.
Okay. Thanks, Elena. We are remain well ahead of schedule, which is fine, about half an hour or so. Next up, we go on to energy with Rob Seacon. Rob, over to you.
All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm Rob Seacon. I'm the finance director with the Energy Business Unit. I'll be walking you through the modeling slides for energy. We also have Glenn Birchnell on the line, who heads up our oil marketing logistics. He'll be able to answer any specific pricing or logistics questions a little later. Turning to slide three, you'll see our 2019 energy P&L developed from information in our Q4 disclosures. The model I'll be walking you through is really the netback model, but I'll show you how the netback ties to the P&L first. The main items in revenue include our proprietary revenue netted against Crown royalties. We also have some non-proprietary sales from time to time, but the net impact of these sales should be minimal. On the cost of sales side, we have the cost of diluent, operating costs, transportation, and depreciation and amortization. As you can see, our gross profit before depreciation and amortization for 2019 was $144 million. On slide four, you have the same $144 million gross profit before depreciation and amortization on the left. On the right, you have the operating netback table, which shows the Fort Hills performance on a unit of bitumen sales basis. The operating netback for 2019 was $11.85 per barrel. And if you multiply this by the number of bitumen barrels sold in the period, you get to the same $144 million gross profit before depreciation and amortization. The important thing to note here, as well as the rest of the presentation, is that the type of barrel you use in your calculations is critically important. As you will see, you will need to get familiar with blended barrels, diluent barrels, and bitumen barrels. Before getting into the actual model, on slide five, you will see a high-level schematic of our operations. This will allow you to visualize what goes into each of the line items in the operating netback. The large blue box at the top is the Fort Hills mine where the bitumen is produced. Fort Hills is managed through a limited partnership and operated by a Suncor affiliate. Each of the partners takes ownership of their bitumen as it enters the East Tank Farm, which is a partnership between Suncor and local First Nations and operated by Suncor. Check acquires diluent from the Edmonton area and ships it to the East Tank Farm on the Norlite pipeline. Diluent and the bitumen is then blended at the East Tank Farm facility. The blended bitumen is then shipped to Hardisty on the Wood Buffalo pipeline system. We have a 425,000 barrel tank at Hardisty to manage inventory. Our product is either sold at Hardisty via pipeline or rail loading. We also send approximately 10,000 barrels per day to the U.S. Gulf Coast on the Keystone pipeline. You will notice the color coding. The light blue or teal represents all the items that factor into the bitumen price realized in the operating netback. This will include all our sales net of diluent costs, which includes the cost of the product, and the cost to store and transport and blend the diluent. The dark purple represents the transportation cost in the netback, while the blue box in the top would be the site operating costs. On slide six, you have the actual model. I'll be walking through each of the bars on the following slides, but I did want to highlight a few things here. The left side of the chart represents the revenue piece in U.S. dollars and also converted into Canadian, starting from WTI and taking you to blended bitumen price realized of $45.20 U.S. per barrel that you see in our disclosures, essentially the price we get for our product. Important to note that the left side is on a blended bitumen basis. The right side is the operating netback in Canadian dollars and on a bitumen basis. The middle diluent bar is probably the trickiest, as you can't really take the $7.76 shown here and multiply it by any volume to get diluent cost, but I will walk you through a fairly simple way to calculate the cost of diluent a little later. So on slide 7, to calculate the revenue, you would multiply blended bitumen volume sold by the blended bitumen price realized. This slide addresses the volumes. You can assume bitumen production equals bitumen sales. However, you will need to convert the bitumen to blended bitumen using the blend ratio. Typically, you need 25 to 30% diluent for every bitumen barrel produced. Another way to look at it is that one barrel of blended bitumen contains about 75 to 80% bitumen and 20 to 25% diluent. For 2019, we needed 31% diluent for every barrel of bitumen, or one barrel of blend contained 77% bitumen and 23% diluent. All volumes can be found on page 59 of our Q4 disclosure. On slide 8, we start looking at the individual components of our bitumen price realized at $45.20 U.S. Remember, this is multiplied, this multiplied by the volumes and converted to Canadian will give you the revenue for the period. This slide talks to WTI, which is fairly straightforward. Most sales contracts assume the average WTI for the month of delivery. As you know, WTI is publicly available. Slide 9 is important, as you need to factor in our sales profile. As you know, we ship approximately 10,000 barrels per day to the U.S. Gulf Coast, which usually attracts better pricing. You can see here our sales at Hardisty attracted a WCS differential of $12.76 U.S. per barrel, while our U.S. Gulf Coast sales were closer to WTI at a discount of just under $1 per barrel. Our weighted average differential was $10.02 for the year, which highlights the benefit of our diversified marketing strategy. I'll talk to the specific mechanics of WCS on the next slide. So on slide 10, as mentioned on the previous slide, you will need to know how the WCS differentials are determined for both our Hardisty and U.S. Gulf Coast deliveries. For Hardisty deliveries, WCS is the volumetric average determined on the first 9 to 11 trading days in the month prior to deliveries. In the example here, for October deliveries, the WCS was settled based on transactions from September 3rd to September 13th. Any WCS settlements after the trading period are considered spot. Although small, this could be used for sales after the trading window, including managing any post-apportionment sales triggered by the Enbridge mainline. The spot price could be better or worse depending on market conditions at the time. For sales to the U.S. Gulf Coast, the WCS differential is determined or negotiated on each separate transaction. The question I believe a lot of you are struggling with, are WCS prices available publicly? Yes, they are. They are available in the public domain on platforms like Bloomberg and Platts. However, you'll need to be careful as these usually quote current price for WCS or WCS differentials and do not take the timing we just discussed into account. Another good source is Oil Sands Magazine. The link is provided on the slide. This will provide current and historical pricing. It allows you to dig into the pricing as well, This is also a good source for all pricing impacting oil sands, including WTI, WCS, and condensate or diluent pricing. So on slide 11, we look at market and quality adjustments. Our FRB product typically sells at a slight discount to WCS. The U.S. $1.81 would also capture any spot sales, which could have a positive or negative impact, as I mentioned previously. So on the next slide, this summarizes the revenue. Once you account for the FX, you would take the $59.97 Canadian and multiply it by the blended bitumen barrels you calculated earlier using the blend ratio. Total proprietary product revenue was $961 million for the year. So on slide 13, we'll take a look at the diluent condensate. There are two parts here, the cost of the product itself and also the transportation and blending costs associated with the diluent. To calculate the cost of the product, you need the volumes first. Again, you can use the blend ratio we talked about earlier. In 2019, we needed 3.8 million barrels of diluent. The price of the product itself, which is typically referred to as C5+, usually trades fairly close to WTI, but could vary depending on the market. Currently, it's trading at about a $10 or $11 discount to WTI, which isn't typical. Again, this is available in the public domain. After converting to Canadian dollars, the cost of the product was $266 million in 2019. As for the associated transportation and blending, you will need to make your own assessment based on historical performance. In 2019, this amounted to $56 million for a total of $322 million for diluent. You can assume about 70% of the transportation and blending is fixed. On slide 14, you'll find the operating netback table. The bitumen price realized is essentially our product revenue less the cost of diluent reported on a bitumen sold basis. For royalties, the key thing to remember is that we are in the prepayout phase and will remain in this phase for the foreseeable future. We also have a royalty slide in the appendix, but there's quite a bit of information on the Government of Alberta website as well. Moving to post-payout will depend on things like oil prices, capital costs, et cetera. Transportation costs include all pipeline storage and rail loading costs downstream of the East Tank Farm, including the Keystone Pipeline to the U.S. Gulf Coast. Operating costs represent the cost of the Fort Hills, cost at the Fort Hills site to mine and process a barrel of bitumen. So on slide 15, it's looking at the entire model again. As we discussed, you can take the $59.97 Canadian and multiply it by the blended bitumen barrel sold to calculate the revenue. For diluent, the calculation is found on slide 13. And finally, the operating netback table on the right to calculate on a bitumen basis in Canadian dollars. So on slide 16, this is just another way to look at the same chart, but it highlights why the volumes are important, whether it be blended bitumen, diluent, or bitumen. So slide 17, I won't go through these in detail, but it just provides a summary of the key inputs and drivers for modeling Fort Hills. And then finally, on slide 18, other things to consider when modeling Fort Hills. The Government of Alberta curtailment came into effect January 1st, 2019, and will continue through 2020 with the option for the government to end them early. However, you did see our recent press release last week that mentioned the move to one train operation in 2020, which results in production being lower than the curtailment level. The details of our 2020 production and operating costs can be found in the news release. Fort Hills will go through a major turnaround every 5 years, where the annual production will dip by about 5 to 10%. 5 to 8%. The first turnaround is currently scheduled for 2023, but this could change. We've provided you with our long-term guidance already for production, operating costs, and capital, and this hasn't changed. As we've disclosed previously, we see some debottlenecking potential at Fort Hills, but as you can imagine, we aren't looking to spend any money in this environment. So with that, we'll open it up for questions for myself or Glenn.
Thank you. Once again, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you have a question. The first question is from Alex Hacking with Citi. Please go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you for the call. My question is on the WCS differential. Even before, the current collapse in oil prices, that WCS differential was quite volatile. I guess I'm not so familiar with energy markets. Could you maybe describe what are the fundamental drivers of that WCS differential? And what was causing some of the volatility in 2018 and 2019? Thanks.
Yeah, actually, it's Glenn Birchnell here, Alex, and thank you very much for that question. The WCS differential, you're absolutely right. It really does move around. It is quite volatile. It's mainly based on the overall quality of Canadian heavy crude. And how that crude competes on a North American market. You have to remember that Canadian crude, for the most part, is landlocked. We're only reliant on both Canadian and U.S. markets. Those markets can consort offshore crude, particularly the U.S. Gulf Coast, which is the largest market in the world for crude oil and heavy crude as well. So Canadian crude does compete against other sources into the U.S. Gulf Coast. We did see a particular amount of volatility back in late 2018 and into early 2019, and the reason for that is that there was a lot of new production that came on from Canada that was trying to access markets. It was competing with other crude types, as well as there was restrictions on the ability to secure pipeline capacity. So ultimately, because of those factors, we saw that differential really widen out. And then when the Alberta government brought in its curtailment program, heavy supply was reduced, and we were able to start to access markets again. And overall heavy crude started to really get into high demand, mainly because of a loss of production out of Venezuela and Iran. So we saw basically a real snapback of differentials in the first couple of months of 2019. So overall, we do compete, but it is based on the quality and trying to access markets.
Thank you. And there are no further questions registered at this time, so I'll turn the meeting back over to Mr. Phillips.